Good afternoon and welcome everyone to the Community Engagement New Approaches and Success Stories Internet Web Seminar Series sponsored by the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences Superfund Research Program. This is the third session titled Community Engagement Activities in Native American Communities. I'm Chuck Maurice, Superfund and Technology Liaison with EPA Region 5 and Office of Research and Development, and I will be the moderator for today's session. We will get started in a few moments. While we wait for others to log on, I would like to cover a few housekeeping items. When you registered, you were directed to this seminar's specific URL, which is the front page of today's seminar. The front page of the webcast contains a short abstract of today's session. We have also included short bio sketches of the presenters. Please note the presenters' email addresses are hotlinked on that page in case you have any questions after today's presentation. For those of you joining us via the phone lines, your phones were placed on mute when you joined the call. We will have question and answer sessions, at which point you can take your phone off mute. We ask that phone participants keep their phones on mute during the question and answer session unless you are asking a question. To unmute your phone during the question and answer session, you will need to dial *7. You may also need to press your phone's mute button if you previously put yourself on hold or on mute. If you ask your question, after you've asked your questions, please place your phone back on mute by pressing *6 or using your phone's mute button. Once again, *6 is for muting your phone, *7 is to unmute your phones. This will greatly reduce the background noises that can disrupt the quality of the audio transmission. Also, please do not put us on hold. Many organizations have hold music or advertisements that can be very disruptive to the call. By now, those of you participating via the phone lines should have the presentation open and should be on *1. All of those participating via the Internet should have clicked on the Go to Session icon near the bottom of the page and should be on *1 of the presentation. As explained on *2, the main page contains the slides, above which you will find navigational icons. Internet participants may submit questions by using the question mark icon you see above the slide and need not wait until the question and answer period to submit a question. In fact, we encourage you to submit in advance of the question and answer session. Also, if you experience technical difficulties with the audio stream, you may use the question mark icon to alert us to the technical difficulties you are encountering. Please include a telephone number where you can be reached, and we will try to help you troubleshoot the problem. The presenter will be announcing the number of the slide to which they are moving. You may advance to the next slide using the single right arrow located above the slide, or by clicking on the appropriate slide number in the left-hand frame. At the end of the presentations, we will walk you through our links page, where we have assembled resources directly applicable to today's topic. Associated with the links page is an online feedback form, and we ask that you consider filling out the online feedback form. We do look at your comments as we continue to try to improve the content and the delivery mechanisms. This will stay with the seminar indefinitely, so you can access it after the presentations. We typically place these seminars in an archive with the soundtrack. In the near future, you will be able to access the slides and hear the presentations as they were given today. Past web seminars are available on the CLUIN website and are also accessible via iTunes by searching for Superfund Research Program. which will take you to the Hazardous Waste Cleanup Information, or CLUIN, archives, and the new SRP Research Brief podcasts. With that, we are ready to start the session. Once more, I would like to remind phone participants to keep your phones on mute, and again, please do not put us on hold. Our first presentation today is from Dr. Barbara Harper and Dr. Anna Harding. Dr. Harper is a risk assessor and board-certified toxicologist with 30 years of experience. She received her PhD from the University of Texas at Austin. In her present position, Dr. Harper is a toxicologist in the Department of Science and Engineering at the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation. She is a co-investigator with OSU's Community Engagement Corps in the Superfund Research Center. She is responsible for coordinating the Hanford Nuclear Project work with DOE funding, such as risk assessment review and performance, nuclear waste analysis and disposal plans, regulatory review, and natural resource damage assessment. She was the PI on the EPA STAR grant that supported the development of the tribal environmental exposure scenarios and works with a number of tribes on environmental contaminant issues. This work is evolving into native natural resources and climate change. She also coordinates several other research projects in coordination with Oregon State University and Eastern Oregon University related to environmental health and tribal rights and resources. Anna K. Harding is a professor and graduate coordinator in the Department of Public Health at Oregon State University. Her expertise is in the area of environmental health and includes water quality, public health effects associated with chemical contamination, community stakeholder environment involvement, and tribal environmental health. She serves as the PI of the Community Engagement Corps for OSU's Superfund Research Center. The Corps is investigating PAH exposures associated with traditional cultural practices with the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation. She is also the co-investigator on an NIEHS grant to use passive samplers in the Gulf of Mexico before, during, and post-impact from the Deepwater Horizon oil spill of spring 2010. She oversees the outreach component for this project. She worked for 12 years previously with the Technical Outreach Services for Communities Program, the outreach program with the EPA-funded Western Region Hazardous Substances Research Center, which provided technical assistance to minority and low-income communities affected by a wide range of hazardous substances. Thank you, Drs. Harper and Harding. So, for joining us, and so I will turn the mic over to you.
Good morning or good afternoon, as the case may be. I'm Anna Harding, Professor of Public Health at Oregon State University. My work is in the area of environmental health, as was just explained, and I am the principal investigator of the Community Engagement Corps for Oregon State University's SRP. Barbara Harper, who is a co-investigator with the Engagement Corps, and I are co-presenting this webinar. We've been working closely together for the past 10 years on various tribal research projects.
Good morning. I'm Barbara Harper, a toxicologist with the Department of Science and Engineering of the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation, abbreviated as CTUIR, in Northeast Oregon and Southeast Washington. I primarily work on the Department of Energy's Hanford site, which is a Superfund site that affects CTUIR lands, health, and resources. I've been working on tribal environmental health and risk assessment for about 15 years.
Please go to slide number 4. This is Anna. Our SRP Center at Oregon State University is focused on PAHs, as you can see by the title. This slide lists the various projects and cores supported by the center. We have 5 active research projects in the center, including several biomedical projects and several non-biomedical projects. We also have 5 cores. When we submitted our center proposal, our core, the Community Engagement Core, was known as the Community Outreach Core, and it was not required for submission. However, our center director, Dave Williams, chose to include our core in the proposal, and as it turns out, a Community Engagement Core is now a required core among Superfund research programs. When the topic of PAHs was identified at OSU, I approached CTUIR to ask if there was interest in participating and if there were tribal-specific data needs related to PAHs.
This is Barbara. Traditionally, community engagement cores were strictly educational outreach and did not allow research. When approached by OSU, we did not see an immediate point of engagement with some projects, but we did see a potential link with the air monitoring and the chemical analysis projects, as long as we could also fill data gaps of our own. Please go to slide 5. This is still Barbara. Here's some context. The 3 tribes make up the CTUIR, Cayuse, Umatilla, and Walla Walla. They've lived on the Columbia River Plateau for over 10,000 years throughout the shaded area and the outlined white areas as shown on the white in northeastern Oregon and southeastern Washington. In 1855, the tribes and the United States government negotiated a treaty in which the tribes ceded most of the land in exchange for permanent protected reservation land and perpetually reserved rights to fish, hunt, and gather traditional foods and medicines throughout the ceded areas in common with the incoming settlers. The traditional religion of the tribes is called the Washout or Seven Drums, and is widely practiced and woven into daily reservation life and governmental operations. Even non-Native employees are expected to abide by its rules, such as respecting and protecting the resources, respect for elders, and so on. Please go to slide 6.
This is Anna. The relationship that investigators at OSU have with CTUIR has developed over a number of years. Barbara and I started working together in 1998 and subsequently were co-investigators on an EPA STAR grant. Although I had no idea what I was getting into at that point in time, we were successfully funded and our work on a number of other tribal environmental health projects has continued ever since. In addition, OSU has a signed memorandum of understanding with CTUIR's Department of Science and Engineering to foster tribal research and research partnerships.
This is Barbara. I was PI on that STAR grant, and its purpose was to develop ecologically based exposure scenarios for use by tribes in risk assessments, for example, at Superfund sites. At the time, tribes and EPA had no scenarios that reflected traditional subsistence lifestyles, although it was obvious that conventional suburban scenarios were not appropriate. So CTUIR and OSU work together as co-equal investigators. Both of us have presented the work, and we've both been first author on papers. The point of this is that it was a mutual effort with equal science on both sides, not simply a university supplying science and research results to the tribe. Please go to the next slide. This is still Barbara. The job of tribal leaders is to secure the homeland for the children and grandchildren. Like all sovereign nations, tribal governments have a responsibility to ensure the well-being of their homeland and people. And like all governments, tribal leaders and staff are stretched thin providing services to the citizens, implementing laws and programs, and generally protecting tribal rights, culture, and resources. Therefore, university research projects and federal initiatives have to fit into this milieu and compete for attention and staff time, no matter how beneficial the project could be for the tribe. Please go to slide 8. This is still Barbara. American Indian tribes are sovereign territories of the United States. This is a defining feature of American Indian tribes and differentiates them from other communities with whom researchers might work. Despite formal recognition of tribal sovereignty, indigenous communities and events are often not recognized as extensions of sovereign governments.
This is Anna. It is important for researchers to recognize that each tribe and tribal community is unique. For example, different tribal governments are organized differently. Tribal decisions may be made via differing formal or informal processes, and authority in various spheres may reside in different places. As a consequence, respectful researchers will need to work with the tribe to identify appropriate avenues, protocols, and experts relevant to their proposed work. It's rare that a federally funded initiative is timely and sustained, that the grant is received by the university when the results are needed by the tribe, and that the tribe is ready with adequate staff and processes in place. Next slide, number 9.
This is Barbara. This slide illustrates the natural law of the CTYR as drawn by the tribe. CTYR culture encompasses a system of knowledge and behavior that has evolved over the 10,000 years that they've been living in the Columbia Basin. It shows the relationships between the various aspects of tribal life. This place-specific way of living is based on deep and nuanced environmental knowledge. Traditional law tells people how to live properly and to thrive in a particular place, and this will form the basis for defining health and well-being within this grant. University researchers may find it challenging to incorporate these kinds of non-Western scientific paradigms into their research concepts within the constraints of a collaborative project. Please go to slide 10. As a visual tool, if one overlays the elements of the natural law over a keystone location and activity, in this case salmon fishing, one can begin to grasp the magnitude of impacts that occurred when Salilo Falls, in this picture, was lost to a dam in 1957. The impacts to all aspects of tribal life are still being tremendously affected, including health and psychology. As it says on the top of the slide, health means healthy people in a healthy environment participating with the community in an eco-cultural system following the natural laws and seamless cycles. So one of the reasons we are investigating PAHs in salmon as part of this grant is due to the importance of salmon, not only as a primary source of food, but also for its cultural and historical significance. Please go to slide 11.
This is Anna. It is challenging for researchers outside a tribal community to understand the issues that may have a bearing on the research process. The majority of investigators and students within our SRP had never done research with the tribes, so the Engagement Corps took this opportunity to educate the OSU community about tribal research issues. We sponsored a symposium in April 2010 focused on important issues and perspectives to consider when doing research with tribal communities, including tribal legal issues, research ethics, concepts in indigenous and Western science, and integration of sociocultural health indicators in tribal risk research. The symposium featured speakers from CTUIR, the Swinomish tribal community, and a tribal legal scholar. The research symposium presentation and speaker details are on the website noted on the slide, and you're welcome to visit this site. Please go to the next slide, number 12. Another challenge that we faced was to match up needs and goals of the tribe with that of other projects being proposed in our SRP. The way we solved this dilemma was to fully integrate our efforts in the Engagement Corps with several of the other projects and the Analytical Chemistry and Research Translation Corps. The benefit of this is that now a much larger group of investigators from the center is participating in research with the tribe.
This is Barbara. Because the CTUIR has considerable research capability itself, we're able to be truly equal partners in the Engagement Corps. For this grant, the model of community engagement is not just transmission of summary information as depicted on the left-hand side of the slide, but rather one in which both OSU and tribal scientists are working together in all aspects of the research core. So the outreach is from the team of university and tribal scientists to their publics together, including communities, colleagues, and publications. Now, not all tribes are at this level, but we encourage NIEHS to allow tribes to guide some of the research rather than just passively receiving results. Please go to slide 13. This is still Barbara. The C2IR identified several PAH research needs on the reservation. They included air quality issues of agricultural field burning, wood burning fireplaces used for home heating, a fairly large diesel truck stop, and a coal burning power plant upwind of the reservation. So particulate PAHs in outdoor ambient air was included as part of the research. Another exposure pathway is ingestion. Given the importance of fish in a traditional culture and the prevalence of preserving fish through smoking, this was an obvious area of study. It includes both inhalation exposure during the smoking process and a wider exposure to people who eat the smoked product. Please go to the next slide. This one is called capacity building. This is a buzzword in tribal and community research. Now, from a tribal perspective, this does not mean only getting information, which is useful, but does not create much lasting capacity. It also means helping the tribe acquire the data it needs, building laboratory skills in a tribal department rather than just in one research assistant, and other things. It also means building a parallel capacity within universities of people who know how to work with tribes, understand a broader worldview, understand the data needs, and who can be flexible in working with tribal schedules and processes. Now, not all of these definitions are addressed in the engagement core, but developing both tribal and university capacity is a goal of this grant. Please go to the next slide, number 15.
This is Anna now. The goal and aims of the engagement core were formally developed as shown on this slide. The CTUIR and other U.S. tribes are engaged in traditional and cultural practices that may result in increased risk due to PAH exposures from traditionally smoked foods, air exposure from traditional smoking practices, and ambient air pollution.
This is Barbara. Tribal members cannot give up their culture and religion or move from their homelands in order to avoid contaminants. Therefore, it will be important for us to better understand the nature of these exposures and to develop and communicate risk reduction strategies that offer the best opportunity to improve the community's health without adversely affecting traditional cultural practices. Please go to slide 16.
This is Anna. Most community-based projects will set up an advisory committee at the start of the project, which was the first aim of our core. The committee provides assistance in defining technical and human capacity, identifying culturally appropriate evaluation metrics and interventions, and helps in disseminating messages. We hold annual meetings, and our second annual meeting was held here at OSU. The agenda and minutes of the meeting are posted on the website, noted on the slide, and you can certainly go and read them at your leisure. Please go to the next slide, which is number 17. Our second aim involves working directly with other SRP project investigators and core leaders, as well as with tribal members to support the specific aim. Each of these three tasks is discussed in more detail on the slides that follow. Please go to the next slide. So we should be on slide 18 now. We're conducting ambient air monitoring on the reservation. Tribal scientists, the Simonich project investigators, and our core investigators reviewed various locations on the reservation for the ambient PAH monitors and settled on a location in spring of 2010. The ambient PAH monitors on the reservation add to the existing particulate monitoring network that the tribes have. Tribal scientists log the data and collect the particle filters from the ambient air station and send them back to OSU for analysis. The picture above is of Jack Butler, the CTUIR air quality technician, and one of the core's key personnel working with a younger tribal member at the ambient air station on the reservation.
This is Barbara. Because the CTYR will keep the equipment, our particulate sampling has been expanded to include smaller size fractions, which is important since the CTYR has had regulatory authority to partially implement the federal air rules for reservations for about 5 years. And this also enhances our data contribution to the regional air quality networks. Please go to slide 19. This one has photos of smoking salmon. It shows the smoking atmosphere inside the structures used to smoke fish, meat, or hides, and also illustrates that this is not a long gone or forgotten practice. It is widely practiced not only for ceremonies, but also by many tribal households for personal use.
This is Anna. Tribal members just completed the first two rounds of smoking fish in two traditional structures, in a wood smokehouse and in a teepee. And I can tell you from being there that the smoking process and the atmosphere was very much like that shown in this picture. Next slide, please. We just completed collecting personal air samples from tribal members smoking food in traditional smoking structures. The tribal members wore a personal air sampler, which was turned on any time they were in the smoking structure, which measured particle-based PAH exposure during food smoking. Urine samples were collected before and after the smoking events. In addition, passive sampling devices from Kim Anderson's SRP project were installed inside both of the structures to gather data on the bioavailable fraction of PAHs during the smoking process.
This is Barbara. This is an example of what needs to be in place for the tribe to be able to participate effectively for its own sake and also for the university's grant performance. In our case, Stuart Harris, the department director, and his staff, like me, had to make arrangements for obtaining the fish, and he and several staff had to collect the wood, repair the smoking structures, take time off from work, use the personal air samples, collect urine, provide storage at the right temperature, keep logs, and so on. So the tribe really has a project, and the university and the tribe must trust each other to do its own parts on the proper schedule. Please go to slide 21.
This is Anna. This training video that's shown in the pictures above here were produced by the Community Engagement Corps to train CTUIR members on how to use the personal air samplers. Pictured here is Stuart Harris, who's a tribal scientist, participating in the training video, which was done by Yuling Jia from Stacy Simonich's research group. These were the samplers used by the tribal volunteers while they were smoking salmon, and they worked beautifully. It was also very helpful to have the training video available to review just prior to the start of the smoking event to make sure everything was operating correctly. The training video is posted on our SRP website. Please go to slide 22. As mentioned in a previous slide, we collected urine samples, which are being analyzed in our analytical chemistry Core D. Also, the Engagement Corps took the lead to write the IRB protocols and secure IRB approvals for 5 activities that involve human subjects. These included collection of personal air samples, collection of urine samples, survey with the participants smoking the food, focus group sessions, and interviews with the advisory committee members. So all the IRB documents that will be needed for our next year's activities have been prepared during this year. This includes recruitment flyers and announcements, testing and survey instruments, and consent forms, and so on. It was a very lengthy process, but we did receive approval from the CTUIR Health Commission, from Oregon State University, and the Portland Area Indian Health Board. Please go to slide 23. Smoked samples of Chinook salmon have just been collected. Prior to the sampling, the Research Translation Core B and the Biostatistics Core C worked up a sampling matrix with the tribe so that there would be sufficient number of samples for proper analysis. Samples will be analyzed by the Analytical Chemistry Corps. Working with the Research Translation Corps, Barbara and the Research Translation Corps members will then estimate risks using conventional risk assessment methods. Please go to slide 24.
This is Barbara. So during the next 2 years, we will be developing risk reduction approaches and outreach strategies that are appropriate for the cultural context if the results indicate that this is needed. We have developed the focus group questions. So developing a community definition of health is important because the goal of developing risk reduction strategies is not simply to reduce exposure, which would likely have adverse cultural impacts, but to identify the safest way to practice the culture and the safest diet to eat given any presence of PAHs in the fish and other PAH or toxic exposures, and also with an understanding of other stressors or co-risk factors that may be present in the community. Please go to the next slide, 25.
This is Anna. Designing risk reduction and health promotion strategies will also draw from the findings that have come out of the research conducted by other SRP investigators and support corps. For example, the information gained from the previous day might indicate that the act of smoking foods elevates PAH exposures. However, since smoking foods is an important and common practice among the CTUIR, the risk reduction strategy will not likely be to stop smoking foods, but perhaps to pursue other protective measures on the reservation. We will also be disseminating culturally appropriate information both locally and more broadly to regional and national tribal communities and federal agencies. Several examples are shown here on the slide. Please go to the next slide, which is number 26. The title says Integration with Other SRP Collaborators. A major key to our success thus far has been the willingness of other investigators to contribute and participate in our tribal project. Investigators and members of the research teams from the other projects and support corps not only assist with scientific training for our participating tribal members, but they also purchase equipment such as the ambient and personal air monitors and the passive sampling devices. They provide guidance for the collection of data, interact directly with the tribal members, and conduct most of the analysis. They attend the annual tribal advisory committee meetings and will help interpret the data. The tribe also has done a huge amount of work, not as research assistants, but as actual researchers. Finally, we are all writing papers together and have already done several joint presentations. Honestly, it's been great fun to work together in this center, and we have all learned a great deal from each other. Please go to the next slide.
This is Barbara. A unique material and data sharing agreement was developed for this project. Ownership of data is a particular issue in tribal research due to the history of misuse of tribal information, artifacts, human remains, blood samples, stories, and medicines. Despite widespread education, abuses still continue. Both CTUIR and OSU recognized this from the outset, so we spent extra time on data agreements and informed consent. Please go to slide 28.
This is Anna. We were not able to find a suitable material and data sharing agreement between tribal communities and outside researchers in the literature. This type of agreement can provide and enforce equitable exchanges of information that benefit the community without infringing on the privacy of the study participants or on the sovereign rights of the tribe. So we developed one within the engagement core. As noted on the slide, two highlights are, first, that tribal ownership of data is collected by or on behalf of the CTUIR, and two, joint review of all publications and presentations. Please go to the next slide, number 29. I'm not going to read this whole slide. You wouldn't want me to, but we did want to give you a sense of about the six components that are included in the material and data sharing agreement. The first component includes the purpose of the project. The second component describes the types of material and data to be collected. The third component describes constraints on material and data use. It includes procedures for publication and post-completion return of all materials and data. The fourth component addresses data access and security. The fifth component identifies risks and benefits of the research to the tribal community as required as part of informed consent. The sixth component describes the mutual review processes. As a two-way document, the CTUIR also agrees that it has equal responsibility for timely completion of research tasks and reports. Please go to the next slide, number 30.
This is Barbara. We believe that IRB rules indicate that extra efforts at informed consent are needed by tribes because there are always more potential and unanticipated misuses of the data than universities realize. Tribes are under constant legal assault, so it's all too easy for outside parties to take information about health risks from smoked fish, for example, and use it to try to erode fishing rights. It happens all the time, so we're very cautious. In addition, biomedical researchers may not know much about intellectual property rights, or IPR. Ownership of knowledge is something that university researchers may not understand. Publication of tribal information without tribal consent or review is not only extremely irritating, but it can also harm the tribe because it is often inaccurate or is misused. Obviously, we're speaking from quite a bit of experience, and some researchers, not at OSU, are no longer our collaborators and are not welcome anymore. Next slide, please. This is entitled Ethics and Informed Consent, and it illustrates that the engagement core is really operating at the nexus of IRB rules and intellectual property rights, and is also working with a sovereign entity that has its own governmental processes as well as a different worldview. I don't want to discourage researchers from developing collaborative relationships with tribes. I'm just providing advice to universities to do some homework on understanding the setting first, since it is pivotal to being able to work together and achieve success. We would also advise other tribes that universities have deadlines and deliverables as well, and this may not be understood. So tribes often do not understand that both sides have constraints and requirements. Please go to slide 32.
This is Anna. We're going to wrap up now. So in wrapping up our presentation, we offer six key points. The first is that research in tribal communities may need tribal government approval, unlike that is required in other American communities. The second point is that establishment of a trusting relationship between university and tribal researchers is necessary for collaborative research to succeed. The third point is that tribal staff and schedules and research needs may not match grant goals or funding agency schedules, and adjustments may be required on the part of university researchers.
This is Barbara. University researchers engaged in tribal projects should become familiar with sovereignty, ethics, and informed consent and intellectual property rights. Some tribes already have capacity as co-investigators and do not wish to be just recipients of information from an outreach task, but this is going to vary from tribe to tribe. Lastly, NIEHS should consider the broad definition of community engagement to allow tribes or communities to do their own research or set some of the research goals for the project. These may not be glamorous or cutting edge research, but they may be urgent data gaps from a tribal perspective. That's my last talking, so with that, I would like to thank all the listeners.
And this is Dana. I'd also like to thank you very much for your attention. Before I move to the last slide of acknowledgments, I'd like to remind you that there were several web links included on the slides throughout that may be of interest to you. Also, you're welcome to contact either of us by email or phone, and our email addresses were listed on the first slide of the presentation. And, of course, our main SRP website at OSU is also a great place to start in terms of learning more about the research projects and cores in our center. Please go to slide 33, which is our last slide. There are many more people involved in this project than are listed on this acknowledgement slide, but I would especially like to thank the research teams and cores in our SRP. Besides Barbara and me, our engagement core includes our hardworking members, Stuart Harris and Jack Butler from the CTUIR, Dave Stone and Sandra Iwasugi, who are both at OSU. I'd like to acknowledge our other SRP project and core investigators, including Stacy Simonich and her research team, especially Yuling Jia, Kim Anderson and her research team, Dan Sudakin and the Research Translation Core Group, Katrina Waters, who is one of our Pacific Northwest National Laboratory partners, and the Biostatistics Core, the Analytical Chemistry Core, and Andreas Cardenas, an MPH graduate student working in our core. Everyone in our SRP has been supportive and helpful. Our Tribal Advisory Committee members have provided thoughtful advice, and Michelle Burke especially has been very generous with her time. We also thank NIEHS, our funding agency, and Justin Crane for inviting us to participate in the webinar series. So thank you very much again. We're looking forward to hearing your questions and comments.
Thank you, Drs. Harper and Harding. Before we start the next presentation, I'd like to take a few minutes for questions. Let's go to the phone lines first. If you would like to ask a question, please take your phone off mute, press star 7, state your name and organization, and ask your question. You can remute your phone by pressing star 6. So, any questions from the phone? Okay, as we're waiting for the people on the phone to formulate their thoughts and their questions, we do have some questions that have been submitted online. And I'll go to the first one by Michael Gill out in Region 9 of US EPA in San Francisco. And he asks, if the results of the research show major risk, would the tribe consider changing practice of smoking fish, consuming, or processing?
Well, this is Barbara, and from experience, I can tell you that people do not change their, it's not just a habit. This is something that they are supposed to do because these are the foods that have been provided. So we would nuance our advice, like wear maybe a particulate mask while you're doing the smoking, or maybe cut down a little bit if you're a woman of childbearing age. Think about, you know, what's in the fish if you're feeding children, but don't just cut out the practice. So that's going to be a challenging, if it comes to that, it's going to be a challenging activity. So it's not a clear answer, but that's where we are.
Okay, and I'm sure it would be varying by case by case, so I think that's as specific as you can get. I'll take a second one here offline here, off the internet, and the questioner is Rachel Walker from Barr Engineering Company in Minneapolis, Minnesota, and she asks, you discussed developing relationships based on trust as critical to the process of working with tribes. Please discuss how you did this in more detail.
Well, this is Barbara. I'll start. We've been working together for quite a while, and I think one of the critical things is for both sides to realize that the other side has some constraints, and both sides have to really step up and work equally. But as much as anything, it's just good personal relations. I'll turn it over to Anna to continue.
Sure, this is Anna. I think that one aspect that's been difficult from the university's perspective is that is that we have to be more patient than we're used to being in terms of working through all the governmental structures that the tribes have and going through a lot of layers of approval. So patience has been one thing, and actually allowing enough time to develop, to have conversations about what kind of project we want to be engaged in and have that develop over time. And I think another thing that's been helpful to our work together is the tribe can see that we're genuinely interested in protecting their rights and cultural practices is when we develop the material and data sharing agreement, because that actually put in writing that we're all of us at OSU and all of the group at CTUR are both committed to the success of the project and for maintaining a level of ethics and research integrity.
And this is Barbara, if I could add one last thing. A lot of the time a university will approach a tribe and do some research and then say, here's some health advice, you ought to take it. And not understanding that there are cultural impacts and maybe the advice shouldn't be to the tribe but back to the regulator saying, this is what the tribe needs in order to make that practice safe. So it's not a burden on the tribe to make adjustments and give up cultural practices. So we like to turn some of it back on the regulators and make sure the practice is safe. So, thanks.
Okay. And with that, I'd like to return to the phone lines, give one more chance for people on the phone. If anyone on the phone wants to ask a question, remember to take your phone off mute by pressing *7 and then state your name and your organization and ask a question.
Hello, this is Beth Anderson at NIEHS, and thank you, Barbara and Anna, for a very nice interactive presentation. I have a question, Barbara, about, just to kind of give us an idea of, since I'm totally unfamiliar with, you're in the Department of Science and Engineering at the Umatilla, and I was just wondering, how large of a group is that, and what types of other activities do you have going on there?
Well, of course, I can talk to you offline, too, but most tribes don't have an actual Department of Science and Engineering. They have Natural Resource Management Departments. So we're really trying to bring high-quality national laboratory-level science into the tribe to use to help protect tribal resources, health, and culture. And so I wrote your name down, so I'll be glad to talk to you afterwards. We're fairly small, and we run into some of the questions, same questions like, well, what is science and why do we need it? And we do education and outreach within the tribe, too. I'll be glad to talk to you offline.
Okay, thank you very much. I was just trying to get that in context of like when you were talking about capacity building. So, thank you.
Hey, Chuck, this is Andrew Geller. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
I have a question. I was glad to hear that you also need lots of, there are many times you need many approvals needed. Because I'm wondering, you talked about how to collaborate with university collaborators. I was wondering if the points that you made in your talk today also apply to working with other government bodies like the Environmental Protection Agency, or if there are different steps and different things that we need to attend to in developing collaborative relationships.
Yeah, maybe Barbara, you can handle that from the tribe's perspective.
What was the question on?
Working with government agencies rather than universities, is that any different?
Actually, some of the same questions do come up. So, for instance, I work at the Hanford site, and after many years, they all realize that we have may need additional or longer comment windows, for instance, because we might have to get policy-level approval before certain statements are made. So that also takes a long time to build up that knowledge and relation. So when we say we need 3 more weeks, we generally get it.
I was looking at the map.
That's just one example.
Thank you very, very much. May I ask another question?
Sure, go ahead, Andrew. And Andrew's from US EPA in RTP, North Carolina, with the National Exposure Research Lab.
Thank you. It was very exciting to hear about the personal and ambient air sampling that you do. I was wondering what you carry forward with that, for example, ambient air sampling. You mentioned using it for the tribal compliance and also looking at sources. Do you also use that for input into exposure models to evaluate exposure more broadly for tribal members? And is that an interest?
Yes, this is Barbara. Yes, it's an interest in just air modeling and air risks. We also want to look and see if we can see different signatures from different types of PAH combustion, like diesel versus fuel burning. We also have a research project we want to pursue in terms of short-term ventilation rates. For instance, you're familiar with CHAP and other activity-based inhalation rates in risk assessment. For instance, we know how many, say, calories are burned and what's the ventilation rate when you're washing windows, but how does that relate to scraping hides?
Sure.
We can do some specifics in that, too.
Well, boy, that sounds like some great grounds for further discussions and potential collaborations. Thank you very, very much.
Okay, well, we're going to have to move on to keep on schedule here to the second two presenters. And I just want to remind everyone that we'll have more chance to circle around at the end and ask Drs. Harper and Harding more questions when we have the joint question session after we have this next session here. So the second session being from Dr. Laurel Shader and Dr. Jim Shine. Laurel Shader is a research associate in the Department of Environmental Health at the Harvard School of Public Health. Her research interests include connections among contaminant fate and transport exposure assessment and community-based participatory research. At Harvard, Dr. Shader is the lead investigator of a study of mercury exposure in subsistence and recreational fishers in a rural community in northeastern Oklahoma. Dr. Shader is also a research scientist at Silent Spring Institute, where she is studying organic wastewater compounds in groundwater and drinking water on Cape Cod, Massachusetts. Dr. Shader earned her PhD in environmental engineering at the University of California, Berkeley, and in environmental engineering science from an SB in environmental engineering science from MIT. She has taught ecology and environmental engineering courses at MIT and Northeastern University. Jim Shine is a faculty member in the Department of Environmental Health at the Harvard School of Public Health. His research expertise is in the area of aquatic biogeochemistry. In particular, his research projects have investigated the transport, speciation, and fate of chemical contaminants related to adverse human and ecological health outcomes. These studies have ranged from development of bioavailability sensors, mercury and heavy metal biogeochemistry studies, and development of methods for contaminant risk assessment in sediments. Dr. Shine earned his PhD in marine sciences from the University of Massachusetts, Boston, and a BS in biology from St. Lawrence University. He has served on a number of advisory panels for state, national, and international organizations to promote appropriate application of physical sciences in the environmental decision-making process. So if you would then, Dr. Shader and Dr. Shine.
Okay, Dr. Shader will start out this presentation.
Great. Thanks, Chuck, for the introduction, and to Justin for the invitation to be a part of today's discussion. Today, Jim and I will be presenting two studies relating to metal fate and transport and metal exposure in rural northeastern Oklahoma. Our goal today is not to present research results, but rather our approach to incorporating local knowledge and addressing community concerns. So on slide 35 is an overview of our presentation today. I'm going to start out by giving some information about our study area in northeastern Oklahoma. Researchers from Harvard School of Public Health have been doing research in this area for around 8 years, and there have been a number of different studies performed. And today we're going to talk about two of them. So Jim was the project leader for some fate and transport studies at the Tar Creek Superfund site. So he's going to be discussing those. As mentioned in the introduction, I'm the project leader of a study of mercury exposure in the Grand Lake watershed. And this is a project that grew out of our community participation relating to the Tar Creek Superfund site. And finally, at the end, Jim is going to provide some general conclusions and what we've learned through our time. Both of us are physical scientists, and so we've learned a lot about along the way about working with communities. So the next slide, number 36, shows the study area. So in the map at the top, you can see Ottawa County, which is way up in northeastern Oklahoma. It's actually not all that far from Joplin, Missouri, which was just hit by a tornado. The Tar Creek Superfund site, as you can see outlined in purple on the larger map, is located at the former Pitcher Mining Field, and this is part of the former Tri-State Mining District, which included Oklahoma, Kansas, and Missouri. This was a major zinc and lead mining area in the first half of the 1900s. And apparently a lot of the lead that went over to Europe for the bullets for the two world wars came from this area. When the lead and zinc started to run out, the mining companies left, and the site was abandoned in the 1970s. Due to extreme contamination, it was added to the National Priorities List in 1983. And even though it's been a Superfund site for almost 30 years, there are still a lot of issues that remain. I'll point your attention on the map to those red shapes that are filled in there. Those are actually mine waste piles, and you can see them when you fly over the site in an airplane. So that's what Jim's going to be talking about, our work at the Tar Creek Superfund site. And then if you'll go to the next slide, I've highlighted the Grand Lakes of the Cherokees, or just Grand Lake. So Tar Creek flows into the Neosho River, which joins with the Spring River to form the Grand River. There's now a dam on the Grand River forming Grand Lake. This lake is very popular for fishing, both for recreational fishing and subsistence fishing by local Indian tribes as well as Micronesians and Hispanics. There are also concerns about water quality in this area. For instance, there are several coal-fired power plants nearby, leading to concerns about mercury exposure. There are also concerns about nutrients and bacteria coming from wastewater and poultry operations. The next slide, this shows a map of tribal lands in Oklahoma, and you can see Ottawa County again in the upper right-hand corner blown up, and there are 9 different tribes that have tribal lands in this area. Our work isn't specifically focusing on the American Indians in this area, but they are an integral part because this is all Indian land. Much of this land has been developed for mining and for residential and commercial development, but nevertheless, it's important to keep in mind because many residents do have deep connections to the land, and even when there's been a buyout from some of the contamination at the Superfund site, people can be reluctant to leave because it is their tribal land. On the next slide, number 39, the American Indians in Ottawa County, so about just under 20% of the population in Ottawa County belong to American Indian tribes, compared to 8% statewide. And you can see the names of the tribes that have all or some of their land in Ottawa County. There's been a long history of the tribes and the Bureau of Indian Affairs. So back before the mining really began, the local Indian tribes did not want the mining on their land, but the Bureau of Indian Affairs decided that it would be in their economic interest to open up the land to mining. And the decisions of the BIA have also impacted subsequent remediation. The tribes were not allowed to move any of the mine waste. You can see in the picture the large hill of mine waste. They were not allowed to move or sell it because the BIA thought that it might be more valuable someday. And so that's to some degree slow down the removal of this material from the land. And I think it's always interesting on the piles that are located on Indian land, there are signs that say U.S. property, no trespassing, if you're trying to go in. So with that, I'm going to turn things over to Jim.
Thank you, Laurel. So let's move on to slide 40, which is my first slide. I'm going to talk about studies that we've done on the fate and human exposures to metals associated with the mine waste and how that we've worked with communities and Native American tribes on not only framing the study, but how we've conducted the study. So Laurel mentioned those red dots on the pile. Those are the dots on that map. Those are the mine waste piles, known locally as CHAT. So if you look in that picture in the upper right-hand corner, those are not geological features. Those are mine wastes. Concentration of metals in there can be as high as percent levels. So there's ongoing sources of contamination. Not only do we have leaching of metals off of the CHAT pile, CHAT piles, but we also still have the abandoned mines, which have now filled up, and are so we have metals coming from underground from the mines. And so we were looking at how those interact and the role of oxidative processes on metal transport, fate, and ultimately onto human and ecological exposures. And again, our human health concerns were elevated bloodletting kids, potential effects of heavy metals on, you know, ecological form and function. And in particular, there were groups like the Cherokee tribe and the Seneca Cayuga tribe were interested not so much in how these things are getting into the community, although they're interested in that, but what is the long-range transport of these metals? Are they slowly being advected through Tar Creek into the Neosho River, down into the Grand Lake that Laurel mentioned, which is down near their tribal land? So they're interested in a much more different time frame than some of the other tribes, which such as the Quapaw, that were closer to the contamination. So moving on to slide 41. Now, as Laurel mentioned, you know, we're physical scientists. We're environmental chemists. So, you know, we went there and we had, you know, specific environmental chemistry questions and how, you know, we have this mine waste, which in the parent mine waste isn't very bioaccessible, but what are these oxidative processes that occur? And to what metals is it occurring to? And how do the mine waste, the mine seepage coming from underground, the abandoned mines, how does that interact with some of the stuff coming off the chat piles? So we went in there with very, you know, more disciplinary scientific questions. But we realized that we're interested in, you know, as part of a study with co-funded by EPA and IEHS as part of their Children's Center, we said, well, you know, how can we had a companion project looking at mothers and kids and their metals exposures, and how can we both work together to understand what's the fundamental processes that are leading to exposures, then looking at what these exposure effects are. And again, this was ultimately done to address community concerns regarding metal exposures. So moving on to slide 42, you know, as we came into this study, you know, there's already a community perspective on the Tar Creek Superfund site. And I think there was some frustration that there's slow progress in site remediation as it started in the 1980s. And we're here in the mid-2000s, and people are still going on. And I think at the community level, there was a distrust of regional EPA and state agencies, and part of that might have been born of, you know, how well do they or do they not communicate? And there's also, I'd argue there was a distrust of outside academic researchers, the complaint being that, you know, we fly in, we take our samples, we do studies, and then they never hear from us again. So those are the things we needed to overcome. And another thing we needed to overcome was, I think, part of this distrust between sometimes the communities and the government agencies is that I think the community saw us initially as someone who would come in and fix the problem and that we would be an ally for the communities with government agencies. And that's something we really had to fight. And I think we went in there, we made it clear that we're not taking sides for on any one side. And I think that ended up being a good thing. And I think you could argue that as academic researchers, and again, this all is our perspective as academic researchers, but I think what happened is we ended up being, say, a buffer because people could trust us. We're not taking sides. We could often be a buffer between some of the different stakeholder groups. Moving on to slide 43. Oh, by the way, back on slide 42, that picture in the lower right-hand corner, that's an abandoned mine, and you can see the water, the orange water coming out. So that's bringing the metals associated with the mine seepage. So moving on to slide 43. So we need to develop partnerships. We're going into a complicated situation where we have non-Native American groups, we have Native American tribes, nine Native American tribes, and state and federal agencies. And so one thing we learned is that building understanding takes time and being present. So by being present, I mean not going in and doing studies. Much to Laurel's chagrin, I was leading the study, and when we'd go in, you know, Laurel and everyone else would go off in, you know, 95-degree weather, sampling from mine waste, and I'd spend the first day and a half visiting, and I'd visit each tribe, and I'd visit the environmental officers of each tribe and say what we're doing. I'd visit the town offices and talk about what we're doing, or go to the Bureau of Indian Affairs office and explain what we're doing and what we hope to accomplish on this trip. And also, and often we were there with their state or federal people there, and we'd often talk with them and say, here's what we're trying to do. I think that was very important. One thing that we did is we worked with a local partner organization, the lead agency, and through them and through local contacts, both of the directors of the lead agency are Native Americans themselves, so they were able to put us in contact. It was with them that would drive me around to the offices of all the different tribes. And this was really good because by beginning to talk and have discussions and developing trust, I think we were able to get access to some sampling sites that were really important. And actually, as you'll see in the next few slides, we were able to start framing our studies. And we came in with, you know, an idea of how these metals move through the environment, but through working with the tribes, we were able to frame those studies to us get the data we need, but for also them to get additional data that they otherwise not have been able to get. And as far as being present, what we did is every time we came in, we had a community advisory board, we talked with them. We'd have a tribal advisory council, we'd meet every time, in addition to me visiting the different offices. And we'd, every time we went, we'd go to the local civic center and we would present our data to whomever, and present it in a way to non-scientists who understand the nature of how the problems are being framed at the Superfund site. And often I'd go also visit with town officials, so the town engineer, to explain, okay, here's what we're seeing, and here's what it means for some of these management activities. So moving on to slide 44, you know, how did we interact with the tribes? And again, I mentioned we had a tribal advisory council, but again, it's not something that happens overnight, and I think as I talk about constraints in the next few slides, I think sometimes as an academic scientist, we want to go in, we want to get data, we want to get results, we want to publish papers, but it doesn't work that way. And I think it doesn't work that way, and that's fine, and I think it worked out for the best, but there had to be almost years of discussion and understanding each other and knowing what each other needs. But by doing that, I mean, there are nine tribes that, but by doing that, getting to know these people and having them know us, and we know what they need, and we know what they can provide, they know what we need and what we can provide, I think we did some very fruitful projects. I mean, one of the things we did is working with some of the tribes. Laurel and I were interested in how metals and different forms of metals get taken up into plants. Well, we could have come in and done any type of plant, but with working from the tribes, they took us onto their, sometimes onto their powwow grounds, sometimes onto their tribal land, and we said, okay, why don't we look at metals that are culturally relevant for traditional medicinal or other traditional uses. And, you know, part of that arose from that, those years of discussion and years of discussion and trust. And the trust led to how very important and very careful sharing of data and disclosure of data on our part. In fact, we put it a bullet at the bottom. One of the projects we worked on with the community was looking at wild asparagus. We were able to go and sample wild asparagus and look at it and look at different cleaning procedures and be able to present that to the community. In fact, some of the community people made posters and flyers for wild asparagus for distribution. Okay, moving on to slide 45. So what I want to talk about in the next few slides is working with the communities, working with the tribes, what were some of the constraints, but what were some of the ways through those constraints? And again, one of the constraints is that an environmental scientist is not an environmentalist. You know, often we're not there necessarily to speak for the environment. We're here to do, you know, what is the role of sulfide oxidation on metal transport and floodplain soils. I mean, those are the kinds of things we're doing. Nonetheless, you know, by communicating some of the data we get and some of the things we see, That allows more information for the communities, for the tribes, for the federal and state agencies. And again, while I say an environmental scientist, not an environmentalist, often you scratch an environmental scientist and you'll find underneath that there's somewhat of an environmentalist there. So again, we are there, maybe not necessarily to take sides, but maybe to speak for the environment. Moving on to slide 46. I put this more constraints, that scientists are more interested in questions than answers. You know, that's what we do as academic scientists. We want to know, what are the questions? There's me pointing to, you probably can't tell by looking at it, but we see two different flood deposits from different places, one associated mine with one not. And we have really interesting things we looked at and what metals are there, what forms are they in, how does this mean for the risk of soil ingestion at this site? It was a public park. But often the communities, the tribes, they're interested in what answers. We have a problem here, what are the answers? But we're not necessarily there to provide answers. So that's something, that's a constraint, and that's a constraint that we need to overcome. And moving on to slide 47, I'll say even more constraints is that as academics, you know, we can state that the academic reward structure is not conducive to interdisciplinary problem solving. Here I'm showing, you know, a Mossbauer spectroscopy output, and actually it's very interesting. It shows how the iron coming out of the mines is getting more ordered and how it's grabbing on the metals, changing its bioaccessibility. And again, those are the kinds of things that give us crisp, publishable papers. And often these very interdisciplinary problems that you'll have at places like in Oregon or here in Oklahoma, we need biomedical people, we need almost economists, we need physical chemists. And for us working together on that, unfortunately, you know, from an academic reward structure, those incentives are not in place to do these things, although it's very important for us to do as scientists, because when you get down to it, the people that we're working with there, I mean, they're funding this research every April 15th when they pay their taxes. But if those are the constraints, let's move on to slide 48. I think there are ways forward, and one of them is to be present. And I think to a lot of people, pollution is an abstract concept. You might see pictures of it in a textbook. You might see it in a test tube where we're pipetting in different chemicals and looking at different outcomes. But one of the things we tried really hard to do here was to be there and visit people and talk and have discussions and present our data and understand what their perspectives are and to understand what needs they have, so are the way that we can understand each other, and that we can do what we need to do, but in doing so, we provide opportunities and resources for them to get types of measurements that, you know, a lot of these tribes have underfunded environmental departments. How can we get value added to their mission? How can we help each other? Moving on to slide 49, okay, how do we make it work? And I think it's understanding each other's needs. The federal agencies, state agencies at the Scriptland site, they have different needs. As academic researchers, we have certain needs, and the community and the tribes have certain needs. And I think it was very important, and I think what we did that was well, we did a good job at, is that we had these discussions early on with the tribes. We actually, our first thing, we got in a car and drove to Tulsa and had to explain to the state of Oklahoma and Region 6 EPA what the heck we're doing there, and to explain to them that we're not the enemy, and we're not taking sides, but how do we understand each other, and how can we collectively use the resources that we have there to enhance each of our needs? Moving on to slide 50, and I think here are examples of where we made it work. I gave the example of looking at working with the tribes and working with tribes separately, one-on-one, to look at, okay, what kind of plants do you think are important to you, your tribe, for traditional uses, and can we look at metal uptake? And so Laurel and I get, you know, data on metals in soils, forms of metal in soil, metal uptake, but we can provide them and provide them with context on what the data means. Another example is a flood. One of the things we're interested in is what happens when these areas flood. Does some of the metals associated with the mine waste get picked up, and where does it go? And we had been sampling floodplain soils. You see in the middle picture, that was a before. And on the left, you can definitely see examples of where some of that orangey, amber color, almost mine waste, gets into floodplain soils. But when we were doing that, 4 weeks later, a 50-year flood occurred. and put mine waste, potentially put mine waste into people's parks, soils, and onto tribal lands. And we were lucky because we had these relationships in place, and we were able to come in and do resampling right away. And because we have a very nimble, you know, institutional review board at Harvard, we're able to figure out ways where we can communicate instantly some of the results. So that's an example of where, because we have these relationships, we can come in and do good things. Another one was tree cutting and burning. You know, the city was going to go in and cut trees along Tar Creek, and we had data on metals in wood and what might happen if you burn them. So we're able to, like, have the data to help make more informed decisions rather than make decisions in the absence of data. But I think what we did mostly is, because we were not taking sides, and we could go in and see what's happening, we understand the community's perspective, the tribal perspective, the agency perspective, but again, figure out what are the right questions. People can ask us, what do you think about this? Well, if you're worried about that, then maybe these are the kinds of questions you might want to be asking them. So we're able to, by working with people, get them maybe to understand what are the right questions and what's the right way to frame things. So with that, I think I'll pass over to Laurel, because what happened is, through these relationships we made, it allowed us to do the second project where they wanted people working with tribal or local groups, and we were doing this. And through this discussion, they, you know, one of the concerns they mentioned was, you know, we're also concerned about mercury from these power plants, and a lot of people in this area have subsistence consumption of fish. And is there anything you can do about understanding, you know, mercury in this airshed and watershed, and working with tribes and communities to understand that issue? So if we move on to slide 51, I am going to turn over to Laurel to show how our initial work with the community evolved into this project.
Great. Thanks, Jim. I did want to mention on the previous about 5 or 6 slides that Jim showed, he also presented those at one of the community conferences organized by our partners at the LEED agency. And my sense from talking to people afterwards is that it sort of helped them see things from our perspective a little bit, because people have certain, you know, wishes or things that they'd like us to do, and I think it was helpful for them to see where we're coming from and how we're evaluated in our jobs, and again, how we can make that work together. So as Jim mentioned, through our work at the Tar Creek site, we made a connection with many community people, including Earl Hatley and Rebecca Jim of the LEED agency, which is a local environmental advocacy nonprofit. And they identified concerns about mercury exposure among people who eat local fish. These are people who do recreational fishing and subsistence fishers, including Indians, Micronesians, and Hispanics. And the Grand Lake apparently is a great place to go fishing. I talked to one of our study participants. He says he's fished everywhere and that this is one of the best places he's ever fished in. There are also 6 coal-fired power plants in a 60-mile radius. These can be sources of mercury, and so there was concern that people who ate a lot of fish from the watershed were being exposed to elevated mercury levels through their diet. So as our Children's Center grant was winding down, we applied for an R21 grant from the NIEHS Partnerships for Environmental Public Health Program, and we were fortunate to receive that grant, and we're in the second year of our 4-year grant. And I'm the PI on this project, so I'm the one that now gets to go talk to people most of the times that we go out there. So on slide 52, I'm showing the 3 components of our study. So the first component is community. And, you know, it's not actually a separate component. It's actually an integral part of everything we're doing. But I have it as a separate component to highlight that we're intentionally involving community in every part of the study. So Earl and Rebecca from the LEED agency are members of our core study team. They were on the proposal that we wrote. The proposal was written following discussions with them. And we've involved other community members throughout. We're also conducting a cohort study. We're hoping to recruit around 150 high-end fish consumers. And we want to figure out if they're being exposed to high levels of mercury in their diet and where that mercury might be coming from. And finally, we're also doing a study of fish. We're focusing on types of fish that are commonly consumed through the watershed, but we are also looking at the bottom of the food chain, not necessarily the types of fish people eat, but we want to get a better sense of the mechanisms that might explain any differences we see in the more commonly consumed types of fish. So I'm going to talk a little bit more about each of these 3 components. So on slide 53, How have we approached getting community involvement? So again, we have our two community partners on our study team. We also have a community advisory board that meets a couple times a year and gives us suggestions as we develop our study. We have a council of fishing experts, and they've given us advice on the types of fish that we need to ask about on our food frequency questionnaire, and they also have suggestions for how to recruit high-end fish consumers. We've also had some focus groups to test out our food frequency questionnaire, and they've improved both the clarity and the content of these questionnaires. So in addition to those questionnaires, the community has helped us identify potential participants for our study. They're also helping us collect fish samples, as I'll talk about, and they'll be involved with our ongoing outreach and education components. On slide 54, I am describing our exposure assessment. We're looking to recruit 150 participants. Again, we're hoping to include high-end fish consumers. And rather than just doing a snapshot of exposure, we are doing seasonal assessments of mercury exposure. So five times over the course of a year, we're collecting hair samples as a biomarker of mercury exposure. And at the same time, we are having participants fill out food frequency questionnaires. And these include questions about the types of fish and how frequently participants consume them, as well as how they're prepared. In between each of the visits, we ask participants to maintain a log of their fish consumption. And because we're doing this seasonal sampling rather than a snapshot, we're going to be able to answer questions such as, do the sources of dietary mercury change over the course of the year? Perhaps local fish are more important in the summer and fall, and non-local fish, such as tuna, might be more important in the winter and the spring. We're also going to determine whether having a fish consumption log improves the accuracy of the recall in people's questionnaires. So each time a participant provides a hair sample, we report back to them what their hair level is, as well as additional information to help them interpret their results. So on slide 55, talk about our recruitment strategies. In this area, it's a rural area, it's a lot of small towns. Personal networks are really important for making connections with people. So talking to people, asking them if they know people who might be interested. It's been a good strategy for getting people to take part in our study. The only limitation can be that people in some way feel like they have to take part in the study because they know the people and they don't want to let us down. And sometimes it means that we might not be necessarily always including high-end fish consumers. We've had press events for local media. So in March, we gave a presentation of the study results to date, and this not only lets people know what we found so far, but is a way to let people know we're still looking for participants. Okay, we're about halfway through getting to our goal of 150 participants. We've identified fishing-related events and venues, such as bait shops and bass tournaments. Our study partners have given presentations for local fishing and environmental organizations. They've also talked to people at local cultural events and locations, such as powwows and churches. And we've also given presentations in science classes in schools. And fishing is really part of the culture in this area. And so a lot of parents go out with their children, and so many high school, middle school age children are already really active in fishing. We also have a website that we keep updated, and we're hoping to include more and more information as our study develops. I don't think that it's going to be a very effective recruitment strategy. Most of our participants haven't necessarily looked at our website, and so it's not something that we're relying on, but we do want to have it as a resource that's available. So on slide 56, we've had some challenges with our recruitment. In this area, people aren't necessarily used to participating in studies or even being asked. Our study team members who've been talking to potential participants think that that there just might be a little bit of a distrust of researchers, maybe not quite sharing what being in a research study means. We've also had some challenges of identifying high-end fish consumers. And of the ethnic and racial groups that we identified as being of interest, we have had somewhat of a challenge making a connection with the small Micronesian community. There are a few hundred Micronesians. Most of them work at a local mushroom farm. And there's somewhat of a language barrier in interacting with members of this community, but also cultural barriers. It's kind of a small group. It's kind of a male-dominated culture. And so we did have some challenges in branching out and talking to adult members of the community. But we actually found a great way through the Micronesian high school students, and they've actually helped us refine our food frequency questionnaire. They've told us where people in the Micronesian community tend to buy their fish and catch their fish. And in the picture are some young women from the Micronesian community performing at last year's community conference. So next slide. So in our fish study, our primary goal is to measure mercury levels in commonly consumed types of fish. And we want to measure all the types of fish people eat, not just ones that we expect to be at the high end. We don't want our message to be, if we do find high levels of mercury, you know, don't eat this, don't eat that, and a lot of negatives. We want there to be positives. So if people are want to reduce their exposures, we can say, maybe you should use these fish less, and here are some ones that we know have lower levels. We want to see if there are any differences in mercury levels in different parts of the watershed. Again, if there are any hot spots, perhaps we could have people avoid those specific areas. From a scientific perspective, we also want to have a better mechanistic understanding about, you know, how does mercury move through the system? Why are some locations potentially different than others? And what's unique about this system? So we're going to use information about ecology and food webs to help us interpret our results. For instance, by measuring stable carbon and nitrogen isotopes, which can tell us something about the food web structure. Finally, we also want to test to see whether there are elevated levels of metals associated with the mining sites, so those zinc, lead, and cadmium. In this particular case, mercury is not coming from the mining sites, but people are obviously concerned that, you know, with Tar Creek and with other historical mining areas in the watershed, that there may be elevated levels of these other heavy metals. So slide 58. So in many cases, if researchers were doing a study of fish, they would go out on a boat and they would just go get all the fish they needed and then just bring them back to the lab. We certainly may do that to some degree, but we're really trying to involve community members in catching fish. So why would we do that? It makes things go a little bit slower, but it provides a great opportunity for us. We're able to catch fewer fish. We don't need a whole bass. We just need a small sample of it. And so rather than having to throw the rest of that fish out, it could actually be fish that someone's eating. It also provides an opportunity for buy-in from community members and an opportunity for report back. So if someone donates us a fish sample and gives us their name and address, we will tell them what was in that particular sample. And I think that makes the connection a little closer rather than just later reading about the results in a table, in a report, or on a website. It gives us an opportunity to increase awareness about our study and, in general, about fish consumption advisories, and it builds trust with potential participants. So if there are people who are not sure about what it means to be part of a study, it's a lot easier to just provide a single fish sample than to commit to being in the study for a year. So it might serve as a bridge to getting more participants. So slide 59, I show the fish collection bag that we've been handing out. If for people who catch local fish, all they have to do is write down when they caught it, where they caught it, how long it was, and what it was. We've been distributing these bags to current and potential participants. We've been giving them out at fishing tournaments and boat docks, and just through people that we know like to fish in the area. Slide 60. We've also been working with local government agencies. And in particular, we've gotten a great partnership going with the Department of Wildlife Conservation. One of our other study team members, Dr. Bob Lynch, he's from University of Oklahoma, he spent a couple days at the paddlefish processing station on the lake. So the Wildlife Conservation Department has this processing station where people can bring in their paddlefish, and there's a picture of one in the lower right-hand corner. The eggs are harvested, and they can be sold for caviar, and that funds some of their conservation efforts. And then they slice and dice the fish and give the fillets to the fishermen, who are happy to not have to do all that themselves. So Bob spent a couple days at that station, which apparently is a bit of a gruesome place to hang out, and so they decided he wasn't just a boring academic, and they actually got to like him. So subsequently, they have invited him to sample the bycatch from their population survey. So another one of the conservation department's efforts is to go out and to count how many fish there are of different types throughout the lake. And while they do that, it usually kills the fish, and then they usually have to just dispose of them. For us, that's a great opportunity to get samples. And then we can also provide the results back to them, and it complements the information that they're getting. We're also building a partnership with the Grand River Dam Authority. So this is the agency that owns the dam that forms Grand Lake. And they have a brand new lab with great facilities to do ecological research. And they've offered us access to their lab, to boat facilities, and actually offered staff time to help us collect samples. None of the scientific members of our study team actually live really close to the lake, so it's great to have that that opportunity. And again, we would share the results from what we're finding. And this also potentially offers us a chance to bridge a government agency with the community. So there is some potential community distrust of the GRDA. They also own one of the local power plants. So some people in the community think, well, you know, they have this research center, but they also own the dam. Maybe there's some conflict of interest. They own the power plant, excuse me. And we're hoping that we can bridge that and break down any distrust, because they have this great resource with their lab and with their other facilities, and it's an opportunity for capacity building. Finally, Bob Lynch of our study team is also a member of the State Department of Environmental Quality's Air Quality Advisory Council that would have the authority to regulate mercury in the state. And his presence on that council provides an opportunity for us to update other members of the council as our study comes along. So now I'm on slide 61, and Jim's going to provide some general conclusions and perspectives.
And I think our general conclusions are pretty straightforward. I think you guys understand what we were talking about, where we're coming from. You know, we were looking at it as our perspective as academic scientists working with communities, working with tribes, and, you know, working with state and federal agencies in some of these truly interdisciplinary problems. And I think for us, developing community partnerships required, and I put down time, patience, you know, time, it took time for discussions with some of the tribes for them to trust us and be able to work closer together. It took patience. Again, sometimes we want to go, as academics, we want to go in, we want to get data, we want to publish papers, but it is being there and being open and talking about what we need, what we want, what we can offer, and vice versa with all parties. And I think we should have put in another bullet for honesty, and we were honest about what we can do, what we can do, and I think that honesty engendered trust, and trust in a good way. And I think the benefits were that, you know, we were able to have a better study design. In other words, we were able to say, we talked to some of the tribes, and we say, well, look, we're interested in this problem, and they say, great, can you do the study this way, that we get extra data and you guys get to do your study. And it gave us access to sites, and I think it gave our project better relevance, it gave it better academic scientific relevance, but more importantly, it gave it better relevance to the community. And we're, you know, very insistent upon ourselves to share it with the community. And I think as academics, I think we can do a good job at being a bridge between communities and agencies, where there's often, not always, but there sometimes can be distrust, and if we can go in and establish ourselves as, you know, not taking sides, we can hear everyone's complaint, we can hear everyone's, you know, problems, and we can talk to both sides openly. So I think that's the sense of what we're doing. So if we move on to slide 62, again, if you think we did this, Laurel and I did this all by ourselves, you're mistaken. So, again, these are just some of the acknowledgments, funding agencies, EPA, NIEHS, lead agency, our local advocacy group. These are other people in our research group at the Harvard School of Public Health. We had colleagues from Wellesley College, University of Oklahoma, community members, tribal members, and even working with people from the Grand River Dam Authority, Oklahoma Department of Wildlife Conservation, as Laurel mentioned. So with that, we will stop and entertain any questions you may have. Thank you very much for paying attention.
Oh, thank you, Dr. Shader and Shang. That was very good. We'll take some questions now.
as Dr. Shine just alluded to, and we'll go, just like last time, we'll go to the phone lines first. If you have a question, make sure that you state your name, your organization, and then your question. And in order to do so, you're going to have to press star 7 to take your phone off of mute. So any questions from the phone line? Okay, well, like last time, we'll let the people on the phone think about their questions to verbalize them, and we'll move on to the online questions. First of all, we have a question from Rachel Marshall. She's with the Grants, Tribes, Communities, and Municipal Assistance in Boston, Massachusetts. And her question is, what are some of the culturally appropriate risk reduction strategies exactly?
Okay. Let's see. Laurel, you want to go on that one? Or?
Well, the first one that comes to mind regarding the plant sampling that we did. So some of the, as you saw on the map, much of the land, or pretty much all the land of the Superfund site is also tribal land. And so tribal members collect the wild asparagus that that Jim talked about. And in some cases, it's growing out of mine waste. And so we've been able to offer suggestions on you can still eat asparagus, but maybe try to avoid the ones that are directly growing out of mine waste. And as part of the capacity building, our community partners have a handheld, field portable XRF unit, which lets you measure metal concentrations basically instantaneously. And we've helped them learn how to use it. And so that can be a tool for identifying soils that have higher levels of metals. And again, not saying don't eat local plants, but having positive suggestions of better places to gather them.
And in a similar vein, we tested a bunch of different washing procedures for some of these culturally relevant plants. And so we tested a bunch of them, some that could be simple to use, and we explained how, because a lot of times the metals in the mine waste are on the plant and not in the plant. So we were looking to the extent, if they're on the plant, what extent they could be washed off. So we provided them with procedures, and again, put this in a risk-based concept. So we did this for other plants, but sticking with the asparagus, we did say, okay, given asparagus concentrations like this, maybe you want to limit yourself to X meals per week, per month of time.
Mm-hmm. And we actually followed protocols that were on a handout given out at the community conference to see whether it made a difference. For some metals it did, and for some it actually didn't make a difference. So we were able to evaluate that.
Okay. Well, we have a question here from Olivia Harris from ATSDR in Atlanta, Georgia. And she asks, not sure if I understood. Are you taking hair samples 5 times in a year? Could you describe how you are collecting the hair for mercury exposure assessment? Specifically, that is, what part of hair are you taking? How are you accounting for hair growth? That's her question.
Laurel, you go.
Okay,
we do a lot of mercury studies, so we're looking at each other like, who goes?
Yeah.
Laurel can take this one.
So in answer to the first part of the question, yes, we're doing them 5 times over the course of a year. So someone initially comes in, we have them do a consent form, we do an initial hair sample and questionnaire, and then we send them a reminder to have them come back every 3 months. So the questionnaire covers the last 3 months of diet, and we want to have a hair sample that roughly corresponds to the same period of time. So we collect hair samples. It's a pretty small sample, like maybe a quarter of an inch in diameter, from the base of the scalp. And when we measure it in the lab, we look at the 2 centimeters closest to the scalp, and the hair grows at about a centimeter a month. So it roughly corresponds to the same period of time. You have a centimeter of hair inside your scalp, too, so that's not at the surface yet. But and so we do those measurements in our lab at Harvard.
So what you get from that is so what you see in their hair is starting 30 days ago to 2 months ago.
And at the end of the project, if there are any people with long hair, we're actually interested to kind of go back in time and see if it actually is an accurate record of the measurements that we collected during the previous 4 hair samples.
Okay, good. Let's turn back to the phone lines. Does anyone have a question from phone line? Remember to press star 7 to get yourself off of mute and state your name and organization along with your question. Okay, well, we have a bunch of questions online, so I will return back to online questions. And this one is from Kristen Callahan from Ridolfi Inc. in Seattle, Washington. And Kristen asks, how did you expose tribal needs and your needs?
How did we expose them?
Yeah, that's what it says. Individually, collectively, both.
Well, I mean, I think the initial project that I described, we went, and the project that Laurel described as well, we went in and we said, okay, here's the types of scientific questions that we have funding to explore over the next 5 years. And is there a ways we can work together collectively and individually? In other words, we have individual needs collectively and individually to address some of the concerns that, you know, that they might have that we might be able to address and simultaneously fulfill some of our, or get at some of our scientific questions.
Then we have a question, again, from Rachel Marshall from the Grants, Tribes, Communities, and Municipal Assistance in Boston, Massachusetts, who asks, please explain the statement, the academic reward structure is not conducive to interdisciplinary problem solving.
Okay. So what happens is, in the academic world, you know, they value crisp, tight, very focused scientific research and research publications that are in very discipline-specific journals. There isn't necessarily a journal for, you know, that would take some of these large interdisciplinary types of studies. So as we get promoted or not promoted, they're going to look at how many of these crisp, very disciplinary manuscripts have we published. They're not necessarily going to ask us how many times over did we save the world. They want to know how many, you know, publications do we have. And again, these publications tend to be the kind of journals that would take these or tend to be very discipline specific. Laurel, anything to add?
I think that in the academic setting you get sort of recognized for being an expert on one really small thing. And, I feel like sometimes I've diluted my expertise by doing a little bit of this and a little bit of that, and I'm not necessarily a specialist on one thing, but often to get tenure or to advance academically, you kind of need to have a name for yourself in doing one thing really well. So that's kind of a tension between specializing and being a little bit, having a little bit more broad expertise.
Okay.
The broad expertise that is kind of needed to look at some of these issues.
Okay, let's go back one more time to the phone lines, and then we'll open it up to both sets of speakers. So again, get the star 7 to get off of the mute and state your name, organization, and question.
Hi, this is New York State. Can you hear us?
Yes.
Go ahead. Okay. We submitted a question online. We're not sure you got it. We're interested in what kind of incentives, if any, were used, gifts, other kinds of incentives to recruit people and then to retain them, because obviously collecting fish and filling out those logs, was a commitment. We're interested in incentives.
Sure. So for our study participants who fill out questionnaires and hair samples, we do give them a $25 gift card every time that they complete a questionnaire and provide a hair sample, in addition to sending them, obviously, the results from their hair samples. And for our study participants, for the people that provide us fish samples, we give them the results from those analyses. And in many times we find that they're, especially for the people that are out fishing a lot, they say, oh, you need some fish? No problem. I can get you whatever you need. So in many times they're really happy to share the fish.
Right, because then they take it on as a challenge. What? They need crappy. We can get that. And one thing, I was in another study, or I'm participating as a participant in a study, and one thing I noticed they're doing is that as you go for each subsequent sampling, the gift card gets more, you get more money. So there's more of an incentive to stick with the study rather than getting, you know, at a fixed amount every time. It gets bigger and bigger the longer you go on. So if we were doing it all over again, I probably would have pushed for that.
Okay, let's open it up to both both sets of presenters and ask questions for any of the presenters we had, any of the four.
Oh, this is New York State again. I had a question. I was just wondering, with all this mercury monitoring you did, was there any like efforts, either collaborative between the tribes and the states, or by the tribes or states individually, to come up with fish advisories as a result of this work?
So the state has the State Department of Environmental Quality has a statewide fish advisory consumption for certain types of freshwater fish, and they've done some sampling in lakes in this area, and they did not actually have a specific one for Grand Lake.
And I think also, you know, we do have, this study is ongoing, so we're not ready to make fish consumption advisories or yet, but I think one, we do have, you know, a tribal subcommittee, and so it's through them, when we see the results, we can, through them, we can help them, give them the data and help how they might want to interpret the data and how they might want to interact with state agencies, given some of the information, data, and information on what it means from us.
And we'll also have not only information about concentrations of mercury in the fish, but we also have information about how much fish people are consuming, and so we'll be able to evaluate whether the, you know, risk assessment that the state is doing to decide, okay, you know, this level of fish is acceptable or not. If people are eating a lot more fish, then, you know, you kind of want the levels of mercury in the fish to be lower. So we'll have some information to share to see if their assumptions about fish consumption rates adequately describe this community.
Okay, from online, we have a question here from Aaron Yu of the California EPA, who asks, in Cypress, California, who asks, are the plant study data and protocols available online?
If you email us, we can, because we're still working on that publication. But if you we have our email contacts, you can email Laurel and I, and we can share it with you, at least our methodology.
Okay, and that sort of is a good segue into I'm wanting to make a announcement here before we continue on with the questions, and that's about the referring you to the assembled resources, not for this last question, but just along that same theme of obtaining additional information from the today's presenters. There is that resource page, and we also we'll be having these presentations available after a short period of time. They will be available with the audio embedded slides on the CLUIN website. And then the one last thing is that I wanted to mention before continuing with the questions is that we have a feedback form that can be found on the last page of the last slide of the presentation, and we would appreciate receiving any feedback from everyone or anyone who wants to provide feedback so that we can continue to improve our broadcasts, our webcasts. Okay, so with that, I'd like to go back to, again, we're asking open questions here for any of the speakers. We still have some online, but let's take another one from the phone line before going back to the online questions. Get off of mute by pressing *7, and then introduce yourself by your name and organization.
Hi, this is New York State again with another question. You stated that you did not get the number of participants you wanted who were the high-end fish consumers. Do you know why that was?
We're not done recruiting. We're about we're hoping to finish our recruiting by the fall. I think a couple of reasons, maybe some of it is again that people didn't want to let us down if they knew we were looking for participants, and even though they knew that they didn't eat that much fish, they still wanted to help us out with our study. You know, I think in some cases people say, you know, people who fish a lot say, oh, you know, the fish I caught was this big. No, it was really this big. You know, they maybe over-exaggerated. So there might be people who told us, you know, oh, I eat a lot of local fish, and then when you have them fill out a questionnaire and actually, you know, count the number of times that they eat fish, it turns out maybe not to be quite as much. And then, yeah, then it's just a challenge anywhere getting people to actually, you know, commit to a study. And again, because we're looking for a year commitment, some people just may not want to take the time.
And we did some power calculations on what, you know, what kinds of things we might want to be able to see in our final data. So we did the power calculations to get an, you know, a somewhat anticipated size of study population we might want to give us kind of power that we wanted in the end.
Okay, then going back to online questions, this one is for the first two speakers.
Veronica?
First two speakers today, Drs. Harding and Harper. And
yes, Patrice.
This was asked by Danielle.
Hold on. What's that?
I believe you can try asking your question.
Okay.
We will have a question for on the phone line in just a moment. Finishing one here online.
I can't hear us.
From Danielle Marlin at the Superfund Research Program, the National Institutes of Environmental Health Sciences. The question is, what is the incidence for lung cancer in the tribe? Also, you mentioned that there may be other stressors that these tribal members may be exposed to. Can you comment on what these are?
Okay, this is Barbara Harper. One of the aims in our grant is to look at the existing health data. However, you know, this is a small population, and finding the incidence and then attributing it to anything will epidemiologically be pretty much impossible. So we might work with the Portland Area Indian Health Board epidemiologist to answer some of those questions. And what was the second part of the question again?
What was the incidence of lung cancer? And then, as you mentioned, there may be other stressors that these tribal members may be exposed to. Can you comment on these?
So there's a cluster of what you might call co-risk factors that range from the quality of health care, access, education. There's a psychological, what's called like post-colonial stress syndrome, where there are probably ramifications extending into everything from school dropout rate to suicides, which is higher than surrounding communities. All those things tend to cluster in tribal communities. Just, you know, poverty by itself is a stressor, and so teasing out any causal relationship is going to be very difficult. So this is something we haven't published yet, but there's a whole catalog of other stressors.
Okay, and then there was someone on the phone line who was trying to ask a question.
Whoever initiated the call has access
uh-huh.
to the line. We
no, Angela, I can. I'm still on.
Is anybody else on the call?
I'm Angela.
It said there was five people. Well,
I'm not sure what that was, but anyway, are there any other questions from the phone lines? Okay, well, we still have some in the online category, so this one, again, I believe goes to the first two speakers, and that is one of the aims in the project is to measure PAH metabolites in urine. What was the most effective strategy for participant recruitment?
And that question comes from Diana Kreiderman from the University of Michigan at Ann Arbor.
So, Anna, do you want to answer that?
Sure, I'll take a stab at that. We work through Stuart Harris, who's the director of the Department of Science and Engineering at CTUIR, who is also a tribal member. And he volunteered to help us find tribal members who would be willing to participate in the smoking process, who are familiar with the smoking process, and that who would also be willing to submit urine samples. So we did that on a very limited basis, because that is not something that is favored by most tribal members. So we had just a couple of participants, and they were trained in all the proper air sampling procedures, and then also willing to participate. And I will say that we also paid our participants to account for the time loss. They had to do this smoking process over almost a week of time, and so that meant they weren't going to work and so forth in order to be engaged in this research project. So we actually compensated them for the time lost while they were participating in the project.
Okay. This is Rachel Walker. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. I'm Rachel Walker from Barr Engineering in Minneapolis, Minnesota. I have a question for Drs. Shine and Scheider. I'm just curious, since you are at Harvard and you have to travel to Oklahoma, and I can imagine that that's pretty challenging just by definition, how often do you get to Oklahoma? Have you established key relationships with particular individuals in all of the bands or the tribes with whom you work? Kind of how are you, and this is really, I mean, I commend you for your enormous efforts in working with all these various groups in addition to all of the bands or the tribes with whom you work. But I'm curious how you, sort of the challenge, you talked about the challenges you face in trying to make community connections and particularly tribal connections and some of the historic trauma and the historic distrust of academics is seminal, I'm sure, to your experience. And I'm just curious how you are going to continue to work at that.
Well, one of the better connections we've made is with the people at the Holiday Inn Express in Miami, Oklahoma, where we stay. But seriously, I think what happens, and I think Laurel didn't, we have, how many projects do we have going there now? 1, 2, 3, 4. We have 4 projects going on in that region now. So I think we're there almost, for one of them, we're there almost every month of the year, maybe. And so what we can do, though, is if you're there for one project, so we have one project where we're looking at that Grand Lake that Laurel mentioned is a reservoir with a dam, and so how the dam reservoir management practices affect water circulation and therefore mercury methylation rates. So, I mean, we had a person there last week, 2 people there last week, but what we've also done, though, is we have them, they can run up to the Superfund site and grab some samples that we need, and again, have dinner with the people who are the lead agency. So I think between the projects we get there, I would say almost every 6 weeks, wouldn't you say, Laurel, there's someone there speaking with people there, face-to-face?
Something like that, at least every couple of months, for sure. It is, like you say, it is a challenge. It's far away distance-wise, and there's also kind of a cultural difference. You know, like, we're from Boston, everything moves fast, people talk fast. In Oklahoma, like, we have to sort of take a breath and slow down because things just go slower there. And so, you know, for the Tar Creek project, we'd go out and mostly do field sampling, but we definitely tried to add time on before and after the field sampling to get to know people. And for the current Mercury project, I try to get out every couple of months and spend time just talking with people. Our study team has conference calls every couple of weeks, and I try to keep in touch by phone with our community partners. But it is a challenge, and it would be nice if it were closer. But we do the best we can.
Okay. Well, I'm afraid we are out of time, and I want to remind everyone that you have the email addresses for all four speakers, and we encourage you to interact with them after this seminar. And we certainly would like to thank our presenters, Dr. Barbara Harper, Dr. Anna Harding, Dr. Laurel Shader, and Dr. Jim Shine for their time in preparing and sharing their presentations with us today. So that concludes today's presentations, and please fill out the feedback forms if you can, and we thank you for your participation.